you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 234 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host once again. Today, my guest is Michael DJ Eisenberg. Now, Michael and I work in the Washington, D.C. area. We've kind of danced around each other for months here, if not years, never physically have met or spoken, but know each other from various listservs and Facebook groups and the like. And what you're going to find is Mike's a really interesting attorney who does federal appellate work primarily and focuses a lot on military issues and VA law. And we're going to take a slight departure from our normal approach to the law entrepreneur. We're actually going to talk about the law, but maybe not so much the law itself, but the social issues around military law and veterans' needs, because I think it's a subject that's just not talked about enough. And I'm so impressed with a guy like Michael who devotes his life to helping those who have given, you know, so much for this country and to make us free. So I'm going to walk right up to the edge of a political statement, so bear with me. Try and keep it a bit neutral, but it is an issue that needs to be talked about, and Michael's the guy to talk about with. We're also going to hear about how he became a solo and what tools he uses and how he staffs his office and all those typical things that we love about chatting with other successful solos. But I just want to give you a heads up that that's going to be in the show, and if that, you know, if that offends you or if that's not your cup of tea, you should bail out now, okay? With that said, here's my friend, Michael Eisenberg. Michael Eisenberg, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Neil, thank you for having me. It's a wonderful to be here.
Well, it's terrific having you with us today, Michael. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Well, I am a solo practitioner here in the Washington, D.C. area. I practice mostly federal appellate law, and that's a broad umbrella for veterans benefits appeals, military medical examination boards, and military records corrections.
So sounds like a pretty broad practice area within a narrow niche.
it keeps me busy, and you know, it's a low bono kind of practice. I know one of the questions in your outline is, well, you know, what kind of revenue are you bringing in? And, you know, with the VA benefits, you have to understand that it is all contingency fee by law.
Right.
And then when you're doing the medical examination boards and the military records corrections issues, you have to remember who your client is. And your client are usually enlisted individuals who are not making, you know, a lot of scratch.
Right.
So you have to respect that. You know, you can't charge them what you would a Fortune 500 company. And I have to keep my rates, you know, to that.
Yeah. Well, in people who get into federal appellate law, for particularly for these kinds of clients, the military and VA veterans, you're not doing it to get rich.
No.
And be real.
Yeah. And the sad thing is, in this practice, cases, when I first started 14, 15 years ago, I attended a NOVA conference, National Organization of Veterans Advocates, to learn about how to do this. And I remember at the like the first day practitioner seminar, there, you know, all these new people are there to, because of the change in law, the Veterans Choice Act law that came through under Bush and Obama back in, I think, 07, 08, was basically allowing veterans to hire attorneys like myself to help them with their appeals process before the administration. Because before, you can only charge like $10, but now you can do a contingency fee based on back benefits. And when they said that and then told the audience you could not charge fees up front, after that session, half the audience left.
Yeah.
I mean, they were just gone because they just, you know, it's like, well, we want the money now. And at the time, it was known as a 2 to 10 year process from cradle to end in order to get, you know, the proper decision. And during that time, you don't get to collect any fees. And now I can tell you it's much longer, unfortunately, due to the backlog that the VA has and, unfortunately, the number of veterans we have who need medical help from the VA.
Yeah, you know, it's a horrible situation. It's fraught with politics, and I'm going to say, you know, to a degree on both sides. But, you know, people like yourself who deal with this issue on a day in and day out basis, you're on the front lines, and you see the tremendous toll this takes on, you know, really the best of us, you know,
yes,
those who have served. I'm a military brat, grew up. Mm-hmm. I didn't serve myself, spent, you know, the vast majority of my early life in the military by virtue of my father's enlistment. And, you know, I've always had a deep respect for the military. And, you know, what we do to our veterans is just horrific. So let me jump off my soapbox there before I get too far down the wrong path.
But let me add one additional perspective to that,
yeah,
and that would be the veterans' perspective. Remember, they signed up and fought for our country. Sadly, they were injured, and they don't understand why the government isn't there to take care of them like they promised.
Nor why should they understand that?
And exactly. And the worst part is, unfortunately, and I say this more from an eyeball, that 90, 95% of my clients have some sort of mental health issue. And I don't mean that as an insult. I mean, it's empathetic because, you know, they have PTSD or some severe anxiety or something along those lines. And it really does add to their mental distress that they have to wait for the benefits that, quite frankly, should have been granted to them years ago.
For sure. You know, and then you add on top of that self-medicating in
mm-hmm.
order to deal with this anxiety and mm-hmm. and pain and mental anguish, and you're just adding fuel to the fire, literally. So I have deep respect for folks like you who, you know, take on this this challenge because it's something that's sorely needed. You know, it's interesting that when I was in law school, I was really surprised about how much effort there was to, recruit's not the right word, but maybe encourage people to do a public service internship or go into some type of public service law where they could get some benefits for doing that. I never really felt like the VA or the veterans issue was included in that. Was I just oblivious to it or...
I think you were. I mean, you have to understand sort of how I came about my practice. And I'm going to...
circle back to that anyway, but let's go ahead and do that. Maybe you can kind of explain that to me as we do so.
So I'm going to backtrack just a couple extra steps. And from there, I think you'll see where I kind of lead into this. So originally, I won an ROTC scholarship for college.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, due to... you know, circumstances, I was medically disqualified.
Mm-hmm.
But I had planned on being, you know, an Army Corps engineer. Fast forward many years later, I've got my Master's of Science in Environmental Engineering. I've attended law school. I'm going to, I'm moving to Washington, D.C. in order to be an environmental lawyer. I was trying to get a job with the federal government, different agencies, DOT, DOI, in the EPA, of course. But 9/11 had just happened,
mm-hmm.
and everything. No one was hiring, and so I moved out here anyway. And it was 2000, 2001, 2002, And I just couldn't get a job. And after 3 or 4 years of just trying to get a job, the last contract job I had was at the U.S. Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals, where I'm writing memos, doing legal research and writing or drafting decisions for the federal appellate court judges there. And I took that experience and with some prior work I had done for the Ohio Attorney General's office in the workers' compensation section as a paralegal, I started taking on Social Security cases and then eventually led into the VA cases, the Veterans Benefits Appeals. Sure. And that was just a natural segue. And then from that segue, I went into records corrections, military records corrections, because during a military member's time in service, he may be up before a medical board for possible discharge or possible medical retirement due to his medical conditions that are service related, but he or she starts acting out because they're suffering from some sort of mental health disease because of the events that they witnessed over in Iraq or in Afghanistan or in combat, or sadly, if they are dealing with MST, military sexual trauma, that they're not, ship shape, if you will, right. And that they're acting out and they're drinking or, they're causing fights and they're not showing up to work or whatever the case. And then they get discharged with a bad conduct discharge. Well, that denies them VA benefits. So these records have to be corrected. And you have to show the military that, hey, you made a mistake. This guy or gal was suffering from, the service-connected conditions that caused them to act out. They should still get their military medical retirement, or at minimum, a general, if not honorable, discharge. Because if you get a BCD, a bad conduct discharge, you can't get your benefits.
Right. Yeah, it's a terribly complex process. You have to, help illustrate to the government that the end result is really caused by an event that earlier should have been compensated for, and so you can't hold the end result against the individual. And
absolutely,
it's. I'm going to step into this minefield just a little.
Sure, please.
A little more. You briefly mentioned something that I think really also deserves a lot of attention, and you're to be commended for addressing it in your practice, and that's the military sexual trauma.
Yes.
And, when I was hanging around the military, both as a kid, as a military dependent, and then later in my previous life when I worked in the DOD and worked alongside a lot of military folks, that wasn't something that was prevalent in the news. It wasn't something that people talked about, but it was certainly something that occurred. And now it seems to have a lot more visibility. Tell me about your work in that area.
It's very sad. And, I'm talking with people who have been sexually assaulted. To be blunt, probably raped.
Yeah.
And I'm just so incredibly empathetic of what they've gone through. I just can't imagine doing that to another person. And not only do I have women, but I have men.
Sure.
And it's hard regardless. And then with all due respect, the stigma that men get, well, how do men get raped? Well, believe it or not, they do get raped.
Sure.
And they are entitled to the care and treatment by the VA. It's just hard for men and women to speak up about it. And then sort of on the flip side, you still have the mentality of the military saying, okay, you're still responsible for the things that you do. And I had a client who was used, pardon the phrase, tossed around by those in power in the military as a sexual thing.
Right.
And it led her to make some bad decisions. And we were trying to get her discharge upgraded. And I forgot if it was other than honorable or just a general. And they came back and said, well, look, yeah, we understand what you're claiming, but it's still your responsibility.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, there were mitigating factors. And, you know, it's a sense of violence that I just don't understand and can't get my hands around why someone does something like that.
No, I can't either. And I can't get my hands around it in any arena, much less, you know, a military setting.
Well, there's something I want to add back to this. So the military has, you know, military, if you join the military, I have complete respect for you. You're putting yourself in harm's way. I have complete respect for the military. But the military has a history of doing what it wants to do, which kind of goes back to the decision I mentioned in the records corrections case that I mentioned. But if I may, I want to kind of give you a example.
Sure.
And hopefully I won't get too long-winded. So there's a case, and this is all public, called Hasselwander v. McHugh, the D.C. District Court, or the D.C. District. And it was about a Vietnam veteran, a vet tech, who had served in country, overseas, and was mortared by the enemy in his camp. And he got shell injuries to his neck and his back. He went to the infirmary, got treated. And then when he had hurt some of the animals as a vet tech, he went over to go help them. And 30 some odd years later, a friend says to him, "Hey, how come you don't have your Purple Heart?" And he's like, "I don't know." So he applies to the Board of Corrections for military records to get his Purple Heart. Or get a Purple Heart. Back in Vietnam, you had to have three things. One, injury by the enemy, check. Two, treatment by military medical personnel, check. Three, military medical record. Well, he didn't have it. He had provided some evidence, some buddy statements, some photos, some journals and whatnot. And they said, "No, we're denying you because you don't have a military medical record." A couple years later, he calls me. He says, "You think you can help?" I'm like, "Yeah, I think I can," because he kind of put the cart before the horse. He shouldn't ask for a Purple Heart. He should have just asked to have his military medical records corrected. And therefore, he got his Purple Heart.
Yeah.
So we do that, and we're denied. Why? Because he doesn't have his military medical records. We appeal in district court, arguing the decision was arbitrary and capricious. District courts have a tendency not to want to overturn, you know, government decisions, especially the military decisions. So we lost. And then we had to appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. And I remember oral arguments. And, you know, you have to be prepared for everything and anything. And I did my opening statement. And then they said, basically, "You can go ahead and sit down now." And I'm kind of like, "Oh, crap." Because you don't know what's going on. It's like, okay. And for the next 10 minutes or so, they basically chewed out the government. It was clear the first time, let alone the second time, what he was looking for. This is a board of equity. They had a duty, and we won 3-0. But imagine what a veteran who doesn't have a lot of money would have to go through to get that, you know, that award for his Purple Heart. And you have to go through the judicial system. It's not cheap. It's not fast, and our veterans shouldn't have to do that.
No, they really shouldn't. They really shouldn't. Today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you by our good friends at Ruby, and returning to the podcast, our friends at Spotlight Branding. Now, if you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. And for those of you who have listened for some time, you might recognize that returning to the sponsor position here with our podcast is Spotlight Branding. And Spotlight Branding, as you may remember, I was a client of theirs for many months, if not years, before they became a sponsor of the show. So I speak from experience that if you're looking to build content for your practice and have that managed for you in terms of blog posting, social media posting, email dissemination, email newsletter dissemination, that you can do no worse than Spotlight Branding. They're a terrific resource to draw upon, and I wholeheartedly support them, and I'm grateful for their sponsorship of this podcast. Well, Michael, we don't normally talk about actual legal stuff on this podcast.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I think we can make an exception here because it's sorely needed. And I can't applaud you enough for the effort that you put into addressing this issue. So, but let's circle back around then. So you kind of described how you came to be in solo practice. You know, you're looking to get a government legal job, but as you said, after 9/11, that was pretty difficult.
Yep.
So how prepared were you to open a solo practice?
Well, I made some steps to be prepared. And I know on your list of questions, you know, what are some of the resources I used, which I had known at the time. And the first thing I did was I got Jay Foomberg's book, How to Start and Build a Solo Practice.
You got it right there. I'm looking at it right on my bookshelf.
And I know that was considered the Bible at the time. I think it still is. I know if I had, you know, yes, what resources did I wish I had known about or were available at the time? And of course, that would be Carolyn Elephant's Solo by Choice.
Solo by Choice, yeah.
Right, so it's a more of a modern take on the situation, and not saying that Jay Foomberg's book isn't any good. It's still good. It's still relevant.
I think he just issued a revision to it.
Oh, okay. I know he's been pretty good about doing that every several years. Yeah. So I haven't looked at it, and I know in Carolyn's book, I was quoted in the first edition. Because one of the things that you also have to be prepared for is, you know, when you start a practice, you don't have a lot of money.
Right.
Unless you know, you happen to have like huge savings that you were just really prepared for. And after just not being able to get a job for so many years, and mind you, I had a variety of contract jobs and whatnot, I had to start a solo practice on a shoestring. And when I mean a shoestring, I mean economically efficient. It's not like I was being cheap about anything. But, you know, I started off and still have a virtual office. My office is in downtown Washington, D.C., but I do most of the work from the office at my home, which, you know, not only saves in having brick and mortar rental costs, which is like, what, $2,000 a month in D.C.? And then you have to worry about the insurance and other liability issues. You get a tax write-off based on the amount of space you use in your house. Now, mind you, I'm not telling you what I'm not giving any legal advice about taxes, but it's something to certainly talk to your accountant about. And it's nice to get that little extra back.
The big thing here in DC, you're saving that traffic.
Oh my God. And traffic and costs getting in and out of town, whether it's metro or, you know, if you want to pay for the HOV or the wear and tear in your car.
Or the time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, because that's two and a half hours a day, yeah. You know, going back and forth.
Yeah. When I was working downtown from the suburbs, that's exactly what it was. Minimum of two and sometimes 3 hours a day. And that's a big chunk, obviously.
And then, you know, if there's a weather inclement issue, you know, it's going to slow you down and possibly even prevent you from going in the office. And it's like, did I bring enough homework home to do from the house?
Right.
And
before I forget about it, let me just point out to our listeners, Carolyn Elephant is a friend of the show. She's been on the show a couple of times. Originally, she appeared first on episode 133 back in October of 2018. Carolyn's a good friend of mine here in the Washington, D.C. area. So pick up her book and also you go to her website because she's got a ton of stuff on her website called myshingle.com.
Well, actually, if I may, yeah. Neil, so going back to your earlier question, you know, what did I do to prepare?
Yep.
Not only did I read Jay Funberg's book, but I met with Carolyn Elephant.
Yeah.
And she's been a great mentor and friend ever since. And, you know, part of what you need to do is you need to find people who do what you do. First, of course, starting off as a solo, you need to find other solo attorneys. And then when you figure out what your practice area or areas are, you need to start meeting those people and also attending some of those conferences. I've been very fortunate with the National Organization of Veterans Advocates that they have been so embracing and very helpful. And the conferences are really informative. I've learned so much. And I go, they have two conferences a year, one in the spring, one in the fall. And I always walk away learning something new and, you know, making good friends along the way.
You raise an interesting point, too, about meeting with people in your same practice areas. I think there's a tendency sometimes with attorneys to meet with people outside their practice area because they think, well, that might result in referral. And meeting with somebody inside my practice area, and that's, you know, they're a competitor of mine. Why would they want to meet with me? But point of fact, you know, the good ones know that there's enough business to go around for everybody.
Exactly.
And that there's a lot to be gained. I know, you know, as we were speaking before we started the recording, that you also know another good friend of the show, Lynette Whitfield, mm-hmm. who's in a similar practice area as yours, who herself was one of the early guests on this program on episode 7. So we got episode 7 represented by Lynette and episode 133 with Carolyn. And I think that's something that's a practice that is underutilized, meeting with other people in your practice area. You don't need to be concerned or afraid to do that. You know, you'll find out if somebody says, nah, I don't want to meet with you. Okay, well, you're not going to waste your time.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, so one of the practice areas that I didn't mention in the beginning is I also do some federal employee employment law. And that's where that's where Lynette and I have that crossover. But, you know, I've referred cases to her because I won't take an EPA case. Mm-hmm. My wife works for the EPA and I don't want a conflict of interest.
Sure.
So I'm always happy to send her EPA cases. And, you know, when I also first started, I was getting calls in practice areas I didn't know anything about. And I would refer to these other people that I met as I was networking and learning about being a solo and also regarding veterans benefits law, because if I can't help them, someone else can. And quite frankly, that usually pays back in dividends in the future when it's like, oh, you know, Eisenberg sent me a couple of people. This is in his practice area. I can send it over to him. My wife was going nuts. She's like, you're sending away work. I'm like, I'm sending away work that's not in this area that I know anything about. I you know, imagine all the time that you would have to take to, you know, get caught up and make sure that you did it correctly versus, you know, focus on the work that you are being trained to do and that you're trying to become, you know, more proficient at.
So is relationship marketing or referral marketing your primary methodology for obtaining new clients?
You know, so it's kind of been an exploration over time. At first, it was networking. And then it was, you know, I was on a listserv or referrals mm-hmm. for several websites, you know, like Nova's website. Also, I think for NELA, which is the National Employment Lawyers Association, and also MOELA, the Metropolitan Washington Employment Lawyers Association. And then I started toying with Google AdWords.
Mm-hmm.
And then from Google AdWords, which can be very costly.
Yes.
From there, I then started going from paid, I think it's paid or inorganic postings on Google to organic, or where I was creating my own postings through my Facebook page, and that was helping rise my search level, where I was, you know, pinging higher than others.
Sure.
And showing, you know, just doing a lot of consistent postings and commenting and articles on Facebook. And now it's mostly that, from what I get from my receptionists, is that people say they find me on Google. And I believe that's because of, you know, how I keep my organic activity up.
So you kind of transition more from paid advertised Google AdWords as an example to right. content marketing on the using Facebook as a platform. Have you gone into any Facebook ads targeting specific audiences?
So I will do that with some of my Facebook ads, depending on the content. And you know, I'll spend maybe $50 over 3 days to get the impressions out. And, you know, there's certain topic areas that I find that do generate more acceptance of invitations to like the page. And from that helps, you know, get more people generated to your Facebook page or at least to your website.
Sure. Well, I'm going to give you a little tease here about an upcoming guest that's going to be on the show in a couple of weeks or so. And you're going to learn there everything you need to know about Facebook advertising and how to take advantage of that in an automated situation. It's going to be really...
And I'm going to be listening to that for sure as I listen to your others. You know, the one thing about that, though, is I use a program called Hootsuite.
Sure.
That allows me to pull together a whole bunch of different postings I'm going to make and then automatically send it out at certain times. So it's balancing out that I have a regular presence. So I'm not like, you know, 5 times a day, I've got to send out a Facebook ad or a Facebook posting. And, you know, just I do it at one sitting, usually for a couple hours, and then I let it go for the rest of the week.
Yeah, that's a great point. I use the same program, Hootsuite, to populate my platforms. What I particularly like about it is that you can create a post and you can post it to multiple platforms. So you can post it to your Facebook page, you can post it to your Instagram account, you can post it to your Twitter account, you can post it to your LinkedIn account. Mm-hmm. And that's just an enormous force multiplier.
Yes.
And I'll give another little hint here for our listeners. You know, a lot of people say, well, I don't have time to search the web for interesting articles to repost or to read, comment on. There is an app that I use on my phone, which is really helpful. You can tailor called Flipboard, and it's a content aggregator. So I can say, look, I want to look for articles about estate planning. Have that as one of my standard boards on Flipboard. And I just go once a week and check on it and find things that I think that are interesting that would resonate with my audience. And I repost those.
All right.
You know, links to the original.
Yeah.
And so I'm not, it's not like I'm copying them and claiming them that they're my own. I'm reposting from other people to read, bringing attention to that. And pretty soon the authors of those articles see that you're posting their article and they start to reach out to you.
Yep.
So it's a really interesting way to do that. What other tools are you using? So you mentioned you used Hootsuite and
Facebook.
And Facebook. What other tools can you not live without?
Well, are you talking about
Just in general. Social media or anything else?
You know, it's funny. I was thinking about that earlier as we were preparing for our recording today, and I think the most important thing is to have a reliable computer system. And when I say system, I'm, you know, to be blunt, I have a Mac, and it works, and that's the important thing. And you know, I used to have a Windows machine well over 10 years ago that was running the practice, and then the thing just died. I mean, literally, it just died. The whole thing just went kaplooey. And I said, you know, F this. You know, I am the boss. I can buy whatever I want.
Right.
And I said, I did. And, that, you know, that's the nice thing about being the boss is you can pick and choose what systems you do and don't use. And
all right, having so you know, I'm a Mac guy too.
Yes.
Tell me, what's your word processor of choice?
Well, my word processor of choice is something I'm basically kind of stuck with, and that's Microsoft Office.
Okay.
And I say I'm stuck with because I used to use some of the freeware that was out there.
It
used to be sort of Open Document.
Open Office.
Open Office, thank you. Yep. Yeah, and it worked great. It ran well, but I had too much pushback from some of my clerks that they were just having issues with it. I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't think you have to make excuses for running Microsoft Office. You know, a lot of Mac enthusiasts have gone back to Microsoft Office. I mean, I used Microsoft products in the beginning. I got away from them, and after a while, I didn't go back to them, but I know a lot of other people have. And, you know, there's some really good reasons to do that. And Outlook is a phenomenal product. Mm-hmm. OneNote is a phenomenal product. I know Brett Burney, who's been on the show, speaks so highly of OneNote. You know, so I think that's fine. Do you use a practice management software package?
Yes, I do. And as a matter of fact, since we're talking about Macs, this one happens to be designed specifically for Macs only. And that is Daylight through Market Circle.
Right.
Which
was my practice management software of choice when I started.
One of the things I really like about Daylight is that it has a Daylight Mail assistant that allows you to tag any of your Apple Mail mail items into Daylight directly. And that it makes it really easy to follow up on things. You can add tasks to it, appointments to it. And it just makes everything really cohesive in one spot when you open up Daylight later, or when you let someone else, like a law clerk, have access to it too. They can look at the email history without actually having to look into my my email that's on my computer,
right?
So that they can keep track of what's going on in the history of the case.
I think it's one of the strongest aspects of Daylight, their integration with Apple Mail, because as you said, right within your mail client, you can associate an email message with either a Daylight client or a Daylight project, which relates to a matter, or multiple projects, or an attorney. I would keep the attorneys in there, opposing counsel.
Mm-hmm.
When I was doing personal injury law, it would be associated with the adjuster. So I think it's really one of the strengths of Daylight, one of the things that I enjoyed the most about it. Now, you've mentioned a couple of times about staffing. Tell us how you're staffed. I know you're a virtual office, but sounds like you have folks working with you. Do you have virtual assistants, or how is that working for you?
So when I first started out, you know, it was just me, myself, and I was the one answering the phones. I was the one, doing follow-ups and whatnot. And now, well, then I moved to having virtual clerks, law clerks. And what I would do is I would hire law students. This is part of me trying to give back a little
bit.
And law students will usually be here for at least one or two semesters, sometimes longer. And, you know, they would help me with some of the research, some of the writing, sometimes dealing with clients. I would always invite them to attend hearings if they were in town. They'd be paid, of course, on their time. And if we were doing depositions in town or anything like that, they were always invited if they could attend, you know, pending on class. But the nice thing about having law students working with me is that they really, really want to, you know, prove that they can do this. And so you get some really great work, because they're looking for the writing sample that they can use, you know, for the next job. I know I'm a stepping stone, and as long as you understand that and respect that, because not only are they there to help me, I want them to have some benefit from this as well. You know, learning how to write as an attorney, having a writing sample, you know, to move forward, getting a good reference. And it's been a two-way relationship. And, you know, typically I get some really great briefs. And the way, you know, since I'm a virtual office, they can work from home. They can work from a coffee shop. It doesn't matter where they work or when they work, as long as they're getting their work done on time. And then it's, you know, basically correct. So, you know, the law students, you know, tend to love this, because one, they don't have to worry about dressing up unless we have a hearing. They don't have to worry about commuting, and they don't have to worry about getting to and from an office. You know, that could be an hour or two of loss of time each time they do it. And it's worked great. I mean, you know, the things I make sure they do is that they have to have, you know, a password on their computer. They need to be using a VPN, of virtual private network, if they're going to use public Wi-Fi. And, you know, I've really not had any problems.
I think it's an underutilized resource, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I think in part that's because a lot of attorneys have, in my humble opinion, a incorrect mindset about using law students as clerks. I've heard so many attorneys say, well, yeah, I love to use them because, you know, it's free labor, you know.
I pay them.
I understand, but even in a paid position, you know, the argument sometimes is I can pay them, you know, very little and get a lot out of them because they need it more. I think if we take the approach that we're mentoring these students.
Yes, yes.
If your mindset is, I'm here to teach you to be an attorney, or what's involved in terms of working in a legal office. And yeah, you're going to get experience. And yeah, and if I can pay you, I'm going to pay you. But if my mindset is to be a mentor, to be a teacher, I think that solves all the problems.
And
in my humble opinion.
The nice thing I've had is that, you know, some of my law clerks, I try to keep in contact with everyone. And some of my law clerks I know got that job, if you will, because of their experience here. You know, one former clerk became an attorney with the Merit System Protection Board. I think a couple came attorneys with the VA, and particularly the Board of Veterans Appeals. I know one or two ended up getting clerkships with a judge, both state and county, I think. And it's great. I mean, I want them to succeed. I know they're not going to be with me forever. I'm not going to take it personally when that one day happens that's like, hey, Mike, I got to go.
Now, some people have created the model where you clerk, you know, and and then you come aboard as a paralegal. And then ultimately, if you so choose, you want to become an associate after you pass the bar, that's a path that's available to you. I know several firms that have created that type of career path.
Right, but unfortunately, going back to the introduction, I'm a low bono attorney. I just
right.
don't
so that
have
that doesn't fit for you.
No. And it's part of the business model, if you will.
Sure, sure.
You know, if I wanted to start practicing, you know, in other areas and charge more, then yeah.
Yeah, but maybe that would be an appropriate model then. Well, listen, Michael, this has been great. I know we've danced around each other for quite a few months, if not years, being in the Washington area. It's great to get to know you and to share your experience with our listeners here. Tell them how they may go about reaching out to you if they want to follow up on anything you said or get in touch with you.
Probably the best way to reach me is at my firm's website. Our email is Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, at Eisenberg, E-I-S-E-N. E-E-R-G hyphen or the minus sign law office LAWOFFICE.com.
And we will have all of that in the show notes for our folks to click on as they see fit. So Mike, thanks again for taking the time to be with us today and being a guest on The Law Entrepreneur.
Thanks, Neil. I appreciate it. I also appreciate the extra time talking about veterans.
Yeah. It's an important topic, one that frankly we don't talk enough about in this country, so I'm happy to provide that. Take care.
Thanks. Thanks, you too. Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it, Law Entrepreneurs. Thanks for being with us today and with this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors, as usual, Ruby Receptionists and Spotlight Branding. Make sure you swing on by our website at thelawentrepreneur.com or visit our Facebook page or Twitter account. You can find us anywhere by just searching on The Law Entrepreneur. Also, if you'd be kind enough, I'd love it if you could go to your podcast application and leave us a rating and a review. It helps with our visibility, and it helps ensure that we're there to be found when people come looking for podcasts in the legal space. So once again, thanks for being a part of today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur.